UCR Podcast.
Steve Vai is a busy guy. As you are hearing this, a new release, G3 Reunion Live, is available now wherever you get your music, and it documents the 2024 tour dates that Steve played with Joe Satriani and Eric Johnson, the first time that the three of them had shared the stage for a proper tour since they launched the original G3 back in 1996. 2024 also found Vai joining forces with Adrian Belew, Tony Levin, and Danny Carey for a celebration of the 80s era of King Crimson as the foursome formed a new group together called Beat for an outing of over 60 shows that began last September. It's an endeavor that King Crimson's Robert Fripp gave his blessing to, and he even helped to suggest the band name that they ended up using. The dates were a runaway success, with many of the gigs selling out well in advance. This year, Steve has more dates on tap with Satriani, as well as some further shows with Beat and other projects, including the new music that he continues to work on with Joe. We also discussed the possibilities of Beat recording music as a group. There was a lot to get into. If you're a longtime fan or relatively new to the world of Steve Vai, I think you'll find a lot to enjoy within this conversation. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, please follow us so you'll get new episodes as they're released. And if you enjoy what we're doing here, please rate and leave us a review wherever you're listening. Here's our conversation with Steve Vai.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Steve. How's it going, man?
Good.
I see you're in your nerve center, your studio, all the gear around you.
Yeah, I think pretty soon I got to start using one of those backgrounds because every interview I do, I'm in my studio.
How have you been with everything that's been going on with the fires and everything? Is that near you? I mean, how have you been affected by that?
I live in Encino, and we live right at the base of the reservoir, right? It's right there, you know, and in back of the reservoirs, the dividing hills, and the fire, it was right over the hill, and it came up to the top of the ridge, and they were very concerned that it was going to go into the valley, because here in California, anywhere that you watch footage of this fire and you see what the wind, the effect that the intense winds, I mean, they were 90 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour. It was unbelievable. There's nothing that could have been done. That, of course, you know, it's always good to be prepared, but this was, it was unbelievable the way it created a fire hurricane. Luckily for us, the winds, it was all about the direction of the winds, and the winds blow in a particular direction. And lucky for us, they were blowing south, and the fire was coming north. So it came to the top of the ridge, and I have photos from my backyard that are extraordinary. It was right there, and we dodged a bullet here in Encino, where I live. It's remarkable, really, to see, obviously, the devastation, but also the coming together, the love, the support. It's times like this where people just abandon their, you know, their personal sense of need and help. They just help. It's an outpouring, and it's lovely. And I'm happy to be a small part of that. But we're recovering. The problem now is we've had a lot of rain.
Yeah,
it's a problem. It's obviously a help. But in Southern California, when it rains, it pours. And there's other things you got to be careful about, such as floods and mudslides. So, you know, the county and the city has their work cut out, and we're all cheering for them and hoping that we can support the best way we can and just be prepared.
I think the best way that I've heard it summarized is Marc Maron was talking on his podcast, you know, just about the way he put it, the devil's bargain that you strike to live in California, that there's the fires and the earthquakes. And I thought that was a really, like, just concise way to put it, that, like, it really is, like, those are two heavy things that you kind of take on when you go, okay, I guess I want to live in California. And so there's people like yourself and whoever, like, it's something that anybody that lives in California has dealt with for a long time. So it seems to just be part of the deal.
Well, you know, you hold on to the place that you live and you grow into it. And we've really grown into California. I've threatened myself and my family that we're going to move. We're leaving California. California is the most beautiful place in the world. I mean, crazy politics and whatever aside, it is gorgeous here. You have the coast, you have all these gems, these jewels of towns and cities and the weather. Oh boy, it's just really great. Probably one of the most difficult things about living in California is the taxes. It's very
expensive. Sure.
But, you know, that people are willing to do that because it's California, you know, and it is a beautiful place. And I just, as many times as I've felt like I've wanted to move, it just really has a pull and an attraction. But yes, yeah. Every territory you live comes with its challenges. And in California, it's those things, earthquakes and taxes.
Yeah. You're right, man. You said it right there. Everywhere has something, whatever territory, like here in Cleveland, it's snow. So there's something anywhere. But going into the musical side of things, as we, you know, one of the things I wanted to touch on that you got to be a part of in recent years was you got to jam with Chicago on a couple tunes, South California Purples and Poem 58, honoring the 55th anniversary of their debut album, but also the work of their original guitar player, Terry Kath. And that just seems like for you, that would have been quite an experience getting ready for that, getting to play with those guys.
It really was. It was a fantastic gig. And, you know, we get things that come into the office, their requests and all the time. And usually you'd be surprised at what comes in. And unfortunately, I can't do 90% of it. But as soon as that came in, I'm like, bing, oh, yeah, I'm doing that. And they were kind enough to invite me. And it was a huge event. And it was in New Jersey, Atlantic City. The staging and all of the people involved, it was huge. And it was fantastic. I just played a little part. You know, I did three tracks.
Yeah.
And it was great to get into that project and to study Terry again. I went pretty deep because his fascinating personality, you know, the whole story of his life and his death, and what a beast of a player. I mean, he had his thing going on and he was just forever improvising. There was a visceral approach to the guitar. I highly recommend checking out some of his video long jams. Really a unique kind of a player, just bold, fearless, and creative. It was the 70s, and that style of playing was very open and free. And long jams. So it was great to kind of put my feet sort of in his shoes for a minute and try to honor that style, that approach, and those beautiful songs. So I really enjoyed learning them. But what really surprised me was when I was doing the gig, how great the band was. I mean, those guys, they're still there. They're in their, you know, late 70s, 80s. And the monitors, you use inner ears. And
sure.
usually, you know, inner ears, they can lack a certain romance, you know. I couldn't believe how good it sounded. There's nothing like those punchy horns playing totally in sync and in tune. One of the real challenges with playing with horn players is the tuning, you know, and just the tightness. That I like it when it's, you know, really tight. And these guys in Chicago, they were so tight and so in tune. I mean, they've been doing it for like over 60 years, I believe. And it was such a pleasure and an honor. Great guys. Totally professional, really tough guys too. I mean, they're really tough. But being able to have an opportunity to honor such a legendary guitar player in the way I had the opportunity to was really one of the things that I love about my job.
For sure. Yeah, and you've had a good chance to do that, to kind of honor some folks that you admire, you know, influences, that kind of thing. You've had a chance to do that a number of times throughout your career. Before we move off of the Chicago thing, I'll say, like, you talked about, like, playing with the Horn guys and how the experience can be, you know, not dialed in. So, like, at a certain point, it becomes muscle memory. But if you think back, can you just imagine being those guys and doing what they did and doing what Terry did back in the 70s before the monitors were really great and all that kind of stuff? It's just like, that's where the muscle memory really kicks in, because it's just like, at a certain point as a band, they had to go out there each night and just, and this is kind of the way it was for a long time, just kill no matter what the conditions were, no matter how good the monitors were or were not on that particular night. So that kind of just is testimony to what they have done and where they are as a band.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
they earned it.
Yeah. You do the best with what you got, you know, and I don't really have to imagine it because I've been through it too. I mean, all those years playing arenas with Frank and Dave Roth and Whitesnake, we didn't have inner ear monitors. I mean, some situations, some bands, and even in a lot of the professional situations, based on the particular night, the club, the venue, the what was available, it was a challenge for monitors. Not with the big bands I was with, especially Frank, because Frank, we had long sound checks and he really dialed in the monitors. But me with my band, I only started using inner ear monitors on the Inviolate tour, my last tour. Before that, it's just you're fighting frequencies and everything changes every single night. You just have no idea. The sound that you're hearing on the stage is based on a lot of variables, such as what the floor is made out of, the size of the room, what's on the walls of the venue, what's covering the seats, you know, what is how wide, how deep is the stage, where are the monitors, what kind of monitoring board do you have? And on my last Inviolate tour, now I had tried inner ear monitors at least once a year for like since they came out, and because people started using them, and I just didn't like them, you know. I just liked the openness of being with the audience. Every time I would try them, I'd get like three songs into the set and I'd rip them off, you know. I would use cotton. I put cotton in my ears my whole career. But then when I got out on tour on the Inviolate tour, I was just getting so fatigued with the mess of sound on the stage, because you get a lot of phase cancellation when you've got a monitor in front of you, your amps in back of you, side fills, all sorts of things, reflections from the back of the hall. And it really can, like you were mentioning with the Chicago guys in their early days, they just didn't have a choice. You know, they had to adhere to what was available, same way all of us did. But eventually on this last tour, I decided to do the inner ears, especially because JH Audio, Jerry Harvey, makes these absolutely astounding, you know, they make molds where you go in and they inject this stuff in your ear and it perfectly fits your ear. And the sound is, they've got like three different transmitters in it. They're quite sophisticated. And once I started getting used to those, it's like heaven in a cup. I mean, you hear the same thing every night and there's no the real variables. There's a little bit, and you can mix room mics into it. So we have room microphones that pick up the house, and it gives you that. It's different. It is an adjustment. But what it comes with, I could walk anywhere on the stage and hear myself loud and clear. And also you can really get close to the soul of the note, you know, because it's right there in your ear. So my guitar sounds so good in my inner ears. And I mean, I can hear my fingertips on the strings, you know. You can play with intimacy in a different way than if you didn't have the inner ears, if you were just going live.
That's interesting to hear you say, because one of the things we're going to talk about is you know, the G3 reunion live thing that's coming out. But I saw the original G3 tour, and I had your records, but I had not seen you live prior to that point. So I always think about, out of all the concerts I've gone to see, I think about that show a lot, because it's like you had Adrian Legg came out and was the first one that played. Eric Johnson comes out and plays. I hadn't heard Adrian, wasn't familiar with him, so that was fascinating in its own way. I was an Eric Johnson fan, so very cool to see that. But the best thing I can say is that you come out next. You're touring in support of the Fire Garden record, and there's just this steamroller of sound that comes onto the stage when you compare it to the first two things I saw. And it's like, so if you take that and then contrast that all the years you're talking about that you weren't using in-ears, like, that's a lot of years to be subjecting yourself to just that Vi wall of sound, you know, that you were putting down each night. So that's pretty crazy.
Well, you know, you get used to it. I liked it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
it was intense.
Yeah. I had a good, pretty decent live sound on stage, because what I would do, instead of having my guitars in back of me, the monitor, I mean, my cabinets. I did have cabinets in back of me. They were the main cabinets, but you don't usually hear those very well when you're combating all the other frequencies.
Sure.
So a lot of times you listen to your guitar through the monitor. But once it goes through the monitor, there's a lot of moving parts. So I put little guitar speakers right in front of me as monitors. I have these custom ones built, and the sound is, it's the same as what comes out of the amp, as opposed to, you know, being mic'd and going through the monitors and then going through the gear in the monitors, which usually causes latency, which is horrific when it comes to frequency phasing on the stage. So it can get messy, but it's not a bad sound.
Well, you and Joe are kind of really continuing to solidify this whole like Satch Vi band concept. You recently revealed the lineup that's going to be out on the road for these shows. We've heard some music already, and that's like the thing that you and I and Joe talked about last year before you kind of did the initial dates. Where's kind of the album at in progress wise at this point, as far as, you know, I know that's been in the works, and it was in the works. It's been in the works for a good while, but you guys have also been out playing a lot of shows separately and together. So, you know, what's kind of the progress report on that at this point?
It's interesting how it all came about. Like anything else, it's a surprise and delight. So it started out where Joe and I wanted to go out on tour together after the G3. And we thought, let's get some new songs, you know, we'll actually play some songs that we wrote together. So we liked that idea, and we started, trading ideas, and we got three songs together relatively quickly. And one of them was Sea of Emotion Part 1. It was Sea of Emotion Part 1, 2, and 3. And they were great. I mean, Joe is remarkable, you know, when you're working with him. He's so prolific, he's very fast, and he's very inspired. So I'll just be sitting there in my email, I'll get a track from Joe, you know, that, or just sketches, you know, like a little riff or something, you know, and I'll do the same, you know, I'll send some stuff, albeit it's been congested because we have been busy. So we kind of rushed about to get those three songs done, and we played one of them on the Satch Vi tour, and it was great. And we just thought, you know, this is fun and easy. Let's do more. And then it just started. It just started. You know, we just started exchanging stuff. And the odd thing is, Joe and I have been together for 50 years, 52, and have done so much together, but we never actually formed one band and co-created music together. So the challenge was, my calendar and his calendar were packed, though, because he had Sammy and all sorts of, you know, things, and I had Beat. And now I'm back. And we're pounding it out right now. I mean, I probably get 10 texts or emails a day or more, you know, sometimes we're just, and it's such a fun situation because you there's nothing nicer than working with people that resonate with you, that, you know, when you co-create, you have similar sensibilities, and but you're different. You know, it really brings something to the table that's unique. And that's what we're doing. And it's really great. I've never done this before. I've never worked with another player in this way for so much music, because I'm not a collaborator when it comes to my catalog. You know, I don't collaborate. Of course, I do in certain, you know, with certain musicians, but when it comes to the overall musical DNA, it's pretty undiluted, my catalog. But I'm a good collaborator when it comes to the right situations, and I love it. And this is a really good one.
You do have so much shared history with Joe. I'm curious, like, doing that initial Satchfy tour that you guys did, how did that kind of move things creatively forward in your collective minds when it came to kind of the music that was already taking shape in the background? Like, you know, what did the experience of taking it to the stage, even though you guys have, like, you know, been on plenty of stages together, like, what did that kind of do for what was happening creatively in the background?
Well, Joe and I have taken our playing together to the stage many times. Matter of fact, my first musical experiences with another person were Joe.
Sure.
With Joe when I was a kid. So we've always formed a connectivity of sorts. So, you know, you sort of know what particular parameters to expect when you go into performing a piece of music together. So the writing and all in that process, you have your perspective of melody. But in this case, you also have an understanding of the other guy. So if there's a song, if Joe sends me a track, say, and, you know, it's got a kick, it's got a bass drum and a snare and a guitar, or maybe it's just an arpeggio or something like that, he knows that I know where he's coming from, in a sense, you know, and that there's a good chance that in this section here, Steve's going to do something like whatever.
Sure.
And vice versa. So you have an idea, and this of the other, but it's always a surprise what they do. It's like every time I get an email from Joe, it's like Christmas. You know, it's like, what is this? What is this going to be? And how? And immediately as I'm listening, I hear ideas that I would contribute. It's really a wonderful kind of a situation, because then you're imagining, and you've already gotten a boot up, you know, because somebody's giving you this beautiful, comfortable bed, and, you know, you just got to lay in it. So you have a particular overview of what it's going to be. And then when you take it to the stage, it can evolve, it develops. But Joe and I have had so many hours of listening to each other and playing together, you know, and it's really a wonderful connection. I can connect with any player I'm with, but the depth that you can go is based on their ability and your ability to listen to each other and respond effectively in an inspired way. And with Joe, I've just developed that connection because it was my training. You know, when I was 13, 14, 15, I'd go to Joe's house and we'd sit in his backyard for hours. No amps, no anything, just back-to-back playing. And you have to listen. This is the greatest training. It's something I strongly recommend. You just sit and you just play with somebody else and you just go and go and go and go and you listen. And it doesn't matter what you play. You're exploring. You know, you're not trying to be better than, you're not complaining in your head that you're not as good as, or any of these things. It's about discovery. It's about listening. It's about where do we want to go? Where are we going with this? I mean, it's so great. And with Joe, there's nothing like it, you know?
Yeah, it's fantastic, man. The other thing that happened last year is that you, Adrian Belew, Tony, Danny, like you guys made a lot of music fans decade by taking this beat thing out on the road. And I saw the show here in Cleveland, and it was funny, man, because visually it's deceptive. Like, one could imagine it was easy for you to perform the King Crimson material, but from what I know, there is some of this stuff that really puts you through the paces.
Well, every gig I take puts me through the paces because I want to make sure that I'm prepared and that my contribution is appropriate. And but this one was a little special because I was learning Robert Fripp's guitar parts. And when you're doing something like that, I mean, you were asking me about Terry, you know, what was it like to absorb that? Well, in situations like that, if I'm playing a Chicago song or a Led Zeppelin song or anything like that, you know, you take a kind of an overview of the style and the sound, and it gets filtered through your particular abilities and your musical DNA. But with Fripp, there was strong parameters because the music is organized, it's arranged, and it's brilliantly orchestrated, but it's incredibly challenging for a guy like me. Maybe some people find it easy, but and not specifically because it's shredding. It's calculated, worked out, challenging picking kind of music. Another great challenge of it is its rhythmic counterpoints. There's a lot of polymetric stuff going on, which means two time signatures at once. As a matter of fact, there's times where there's four time signatures going on at once. And the guitar parts that Adrian and Robert worked out are just brilliant. They're just so lovely. And my work was to honor those notes that Robert wrote. And he had a very unique picking style, a very disciplined approach, technique that he started to create. Somebody told me, I think when he was like 7 years old, he started. But Robert's approach to the guitar is unique in regard to any other player I've seen. He takes a very holistic approach. It encapsulates full mind and body, you know, because besides the technique, the actual picking technique, which there's a whole protocol for, the way you hold your wrist, and, you know, he also takes into account posture, goes much deeper. He takes into account your thinking process. And there's very disciplined ways, that I should say, and anybody interested should look into it themselves, his guitar craft courses, and they're just brilliant. But it takes on also mind exercises in a sense, because really that's what it's about in general for anybody. It's about how you think about what you're doing that is at the basis of what you end up doing. And in Robert's case, I believe he knows that. And he, in his way, tries to exemplify that. But at the end of the day, I had to play the right notes. And there was a few of the riffs that were just kind of, if I'm going to play something on stage, I want to feel like it's going to be consistent every night. But there were some things that were just a little, I couldn't really be consistent. A long story, but there was one riff that for Frame by Frame that I was just, I couldn't, it was relentless. And I kind of thought, if, you know, before I had some physical challenges, I could have played it. And I'm happy to report, and I probably shouldn't even discuss it, but I had a pinched nerve in my elbow And I just got surgery on it just the other day, a week ago. And
Wow.
it loosened up. The nerve was being clamped. So it was affecting my arm was atrophying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my
That
picking.
looks like some fast recovery, though, watching you move the arm.
Oh, no, I didn't feel anything at all. It was like they just.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was I mean, it was a real surgery. I've got a
Yeah.
scar like that. But this doctor's Dr. Cody Azari, this guy performed the first human hand transplant. It's
You're in good hands, literally.
remarkable. He fixed a lot of things for me. But it's all opening back up now. And the
That's
other day,
cool.
this is just a week later, I went and I tried to play that frame by frame riff, and it actually started to come together. And I'm like, damn, now it's just a process because the nerve heals at the rate of 1 inch a month, and it's got to go this all this length. And he said, you're going to be getting better for the next year and a half, because I was very concerned. I actually felt I might be on my way out. Because it was just going dead,
Yeah.
so that's nice news. But playing that beat material with Adrian is it's as unique as being on a stage with Joe and listening, because those guys constructed these fantastic, delicious guitar parts that have these interlocking sort of juxtapositions and polymetric situations where, one guy will be playing the same seven notes over and over, and the other will play the first six notes over and over. So it creates this sort of wonderful interlocking harmonies that just dance. The guitars sound like they're dancing together, And doing that with Adrian is great. And just being on stage with Adrian, and the guy is, it's kind he's kind of like one of those unsung heroes in my mind. I know that he has incredible followers that really are passionate about what he does. And he's not part of the mainstream shreddy kind of a scene, but Adrian Belew is a totally unique artist. He has really great ears, intonation. But his ability to create unique sounds from a guitar and make them musical and appropriately fit them into a piece of music is quite amazing. And I would just marvel at him every night, because so different than anybody or anything that I've ever co-created or worked with. I mean, nobody's like anybody else, really. But there's nobody even in Adrian Belew's playground. There's nobody even trying. I mean, he is unique. And that music is just so beautiful. All those melodies, the lyrics, that voice, all there from by Adrian. And what a great band. I mean, I'm listening through and working on the video right now that we did a live stream from LA, and we're working on making that a video. And when you're in it, you don't have quite the perspective as when you're looking at it later. And listening now to everything as an observer is very different than having them in your inner ears and trying to focus on them and locking and, playing and listening. It's different than when you're actually watching it later. You get to discover things that you're unconscious to while you're actually playing. And what a band. I mean, Tony, you got to hear these parts. I mean, you have to like listen to them in solo in order to realize that he's playing what he's playing. Just fantastic and so much personality, on that stick, all the phrases, they have an attitude to them, And what a wonderful man. My goodness. Same thing with Danny. I knew, of course, I knew Tool, and I was aware, And I love the music. There's something very rich and deep in it. But Danny is a marvel. I mean, he can play all of the complex stuff, but the most remarkable things I would see him do was when he would solo. This is a guy that he just never repeated himself, and virtually everything he did. So, like a lot of times for someone like myself, if I do a solo, maybe like 5%, 10% might be connected, really connected,
Sure.
Danny, it's more like 50, 60%. The other stuff is great, but a connected musician is the greatest type of entertainment when they're connected to their creative flow. And you can see this in a lot of people. And you can also see people when they're just going by the numbers, they're just kind of playing, but not inventing. And that's fine. Everybody's on a particular path and it's all good. But when you see someone like Danny do a drum solo, you're like, okay, all right. That's connected. And you totally understand what I mean when you watch him. Never repeats himself. It's remarkable. I sit that Adrian and I just like look at each other and after he solos, and it's, I can hardly even come in playing. It's crazy, beautiful. And he's ours.
Yeah,
Poor
I
Danny.
think it was well known how fired up Danny was as a King Crimson fan to like come out and do that gig. And it's like you could kind of feel that feeling with all of you guys before there was even a show in the books. Like I remember talking to Adrian. I talked to Adrian around the same time that I talked to you, really just as the whole thing was about to be announced. And Adrian was just like telling me about, going over to your place and all your guitars. And he's like, we're sitting down going through the songs that I've mapped out. And he's like, and Steve says, I've got these chords in my head. I don't have them mapped out, but he's like, I can already imagine you singing over them. So it's like before you'd even played a gig with Adrian, like you saw the possibilities of what could happen if you got a chance to spend some time with this guy.
Well, yeah, and not just that guy, but the whole model, because
Sure.
the old King Crimson, Robert and Adrian would work certain things out, and then the band would work it out. I don't do that in my solo music. I'm the master and commander of every note, sort of, I mean,
Yeah.
of course, people have, the musicians have their opportunity to contribute their unique voice. But with something like Beat, it was a such kind of situation where I would always get asked in the press, would you ever join a supergroup again? And my stock response was probably not, because most of the bands want to relive the glory days of yore. And I get offers, but I did that. And I would be interested, perhaps, if there was a group of guys that were very creative, they were interested in doing something creative and different, and just unique, non-commercial but commercial. Like the best type of commercial music is when the writers take an approach of not caring about where it goes commercially. And that's the kind of environment with extraordinary musicians I might consider, but nobody's knocking on my door. And then boom, the phone rings and it's Adrian Belew. And it's like, I've got Tony Levin and Danny Carey. What do you think? And I'm just like that. Not unless somebody like that calls me. And I immediately said yes, because I saw the whole thing in my head. I saw my contribution. I saw working with Adrian and the band and just playing that beautiful music.
Well, so to wrap up, last couple things. You mentioned that you are, working, looking at the live stream, looking to turn that into a video. When Adrian talks about like just that shred of music that you had kind of in your head, I asked him this before the tour had started, how much have you guys talked about the idea of doing something musically as beat as far as something recorded, like recorded studio stuff?
We touch on it, of course. Right now, the goal is to honor this King Crimson music the best we can and play anywhere that'll take us. But that has a shelf life, obviously, because once you've toured the world with it, I wouldn't want to go back out and tour the whole world again doing the same thing because there's way too many things to do.
For
I
sure.
wouldn't mind, but evolve it. Going out there and playing this music was an evolution for us in the first place. So if we do it again, it would be nice to do something additional. So we talk about it. The challenge in my mind is the foundation of the band is a King Crimson kind of oral attitude, harmonic, melodic attitude, rhythmic. There's all these accoutrements that go into a King Crimson song. Now, we're not King Crimson because, I'm not Robert Fripp, and my musical mind works very differently, but I'm a fan, I understand, and I know certain parameters of what might work in something that could work for beat, but also not be too far removed from King Crimson. So it's a fun challenge, and just the thought of that, way back years ago when Adrian first asked me, created an idea in my head. It created an overview of the kind of music I might contribute to something like beat, and I immediately just started playing this riff. And I grabbed my iPhone and I recorded it, and it just sat on the shelf until Adrian got here, like 3 or 4 years later, whatever it was. And I just picked up my guitar and I started playing it. And he goes, "All right, that's it. Let's keep that on the shelf." So things like that work best when they happen organically, and we're hoping that that will organically develop. And that's just, what I'm just talking one riff. That
Yeah.
there's once you open the can of worms, everything's going to start flowing. But right now it's just flowing in another direction. It's with Joe, and then it's going to be with touring with Beat, and then it's going to be in composing for me because I also have a project coming up in 2027 with it's a 6-day Steve Vai festival in The Hague in Holland.
Oh man.
But it celebrates Steve Vai, the composer, because I do have a secret life as a composer of abstract orchestral music. I should say
That's
abstract.
fantastic, man.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to just say abstract. It's Vai stuff, from way back in here. And so that will require about 6 or 8 months of undisturbed composing because I gotta write like 3 hours of orchestral music. So I'm really looking forward to that. That's like my favorite thing to do.
I was gonna say, you and a guy like Stuart Copeland, like people like you two as an example, like the two of you, love the opportunity to sink your teeth into something that is, for what you've done your entire life, it's not a very commercial thing, but it's like that's such fulfilling work to be able to sink your teeth into that kind of thing.
There's nothing like it. Everybody knows that feeling of being in the creative flow of their own intentions, meaning you're doing something you really love. It feels good when you're doing it, and ideas come easily. Challenges look more like opportunities. And the discipline that's required isn't taking yourself out of it. To go back to the, responsibilities, and because when you're in the creative flow of your own making, this is when the best stuff happens. And for some reason, ever since I was a young boy, I just kind of lit up with the idea of compositional expression. There was something in my mind that said, "Do you mean to tell me if I can understand the language of the little black dots, I can control 100 people and make them sound like that. Well, I know what I want them to sound. I can hear it. So I'm going to learn this. And I'm talking like 8 years old, I started, you know, and I've got mountains and mountains of manuscripts. As a matter of fact, we were talking before. Well, I'll get to that. You'll get a kick out of something I'd like to show you. But
sure.
But ever since I was young, it was just something I knew would be creatively fulfilling if I learned the language. And I learned the language very early on. The language is in the background. When you really understand the language of something, like if you're even just going and speaking another language in another country, it's not like you're impressing yourself that you know the language. You're getting a point across. You're communicating, you know? So that's the same thing with composition. It's not like, hey, I know how to compose for an orchestra. That's just in the background. It's what are you composing? What is that? You know, where's the DNA in that? So that was always very exciting to me, and I've done a lot of it through the years. But my orchestral music, it's not conventional in the sense that you're going to write for films or you're going to write something that sounds like, no, when it all comes out, you'll see anybody that might be interested, because it's pretty, you know, it's an acquired taste. But speaking about learning, I have something I'd love to show you. Okay.
So absolutely.
ZZ Satriani, brilliant young kid, you know, Joe's son.
Yeah.
Filmmaker, videographer. And he's pulled together at the foundation of the whole G3 movement.
Sure. So,
and he's forensically involved with the minutiae, because he loves that, you know, of the three of us, meaning the any history we had, any little things that he can then put into the video or the films or something like that. And he knew that I had a whole bunch of the lessons that I originally took from Joe. And he wanted to get them and scan them and do something like that. So I went into the attic and I got them.
Oh, man.
And they're really quite amazing. If you read through these, you'd see where I got everything. It's just like...
Are you guy that keeps things? Why did you keep that?
Because they're made of gold. No, these meant everything to me, these lessons.
Wow.
1974, lesson 20. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but
sure. No, I understand.
He's coming and he's gonna get a good Xerox on these or scan. But there's so much, I'm looking through this stuff and so much of what I do today is based on what I learned from Joe when I was a kid. And a lot of what we were getting came from, you know, our music teacher in school. But I'm trying to find some of the funny things. He writes such funny stuff. But like this here, this was a 16-year-old kid teaching a 12-year-old. And these chords, they're huge. They're beautiful. They're rich. They're flavorful. There's all these tonalities and tensions in them. How lucky was I?
Very. Yeah, man. That's interesting to me. Like, would you consider yourself to be a pretty good archivist type? Because when we're talking of like a band situation, I was talking about this with somebody recently. There tends to be one guy in the band that usually is the archival guy in the band. But for you, like, it pretty much has to be you, you know, or... there's so much that could have gone undocumented. So have you been kind of keeping documentation like that all along the way, you know, from that day forward?
Based on those things that are interesting enough to me.
Yeah.
And then my archival abilities are not really as organized as they could be. I do have a folder and a box that I call treasures. And whenever I receive something that's moving or that really touches me, I keep that. And that's a treasure.
Oh, man, that's cool. Well, here's where I want to wrap up, and just because it is the next thing that people can get their hands on, the G3 reunion live release. What is kind of special to you about what was, you know, documented for you and the three of you guys with that recording and, you know, of that time period of the things you did last year?
Well, so much. First of all, it was the sort of celebration of the original G3. And it was just great to be on stage with those guys again. Myself, I know that I've mentally matured musically over the last 30 years, hopefully. So the experience of playing the music was more relaxed. It was more enjoyable. It was bolder in a way because I wasn't so... I've through time, if you stick with something, you go deeper with it. And I've decided years ago that I wanted to more and more explore my own peculiar, quirky playing. And I'm not afraid to kind of, I don't hold that back when I'm with Eric and Joe, because that's what they expect and that's what the audience expects from me. So that's great. But having the opportunity at this time in the music business to create a package like that, I mean, it's a phenomenal package, the G3 reunion record, because you've got four vinyls beautifully laid out with a book. And, you know, it's for people who are interested in this kind of thing. And each one of us was able to include their entire 45-minute set on a vinyl. And
yeah,
it was great. Plus one vinyl for the jam where we came together. And then that comes with the CDs and, you know, the whole thing. So the package itself is quite extraordinary for people who are interested in that kind of thing, because it's rare these days. So it was nice to get in on, you know, to be a part of that. I don't know if I
for
answered
sure.
the question properly.
No, you absolutely did, man. And like, I think it's a much fuller representation of what the three of you did on that run, you know, than like, say, like what kind of, you know, when there was the live record that came out in 97, that was obviously kind of a condensed take of what you guys had played on that 96 tour. So it's nice that you kind of got to bottle the entire thing for this G3 reunion set. And I'll just ask you, like, obviously you have so much history with Joe, but how well did you know Eric going into the original G3 tour? Because like his Texas thing, his whole vibe, like it's just so fascinating. I think that's what makes him such an interesting combination to be thrown in with you two, is because like each of you, as you said, everybody is different. Everybody brings their own thing. You said that earlier. Eric brings his own very unique thing to, you know, what he does. And it's a cool thing getting thrown into the stew of what you and Joe are doing.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful to watch any effective artist express their own personal musical intentions with no excuses. And Eric had no, you know, he didn't try to make excuse. He just was him. And back before G3, I had known Eric, you know, sort of, we'd met a bunch, but we never really hung out a lot, but we did have opportunities. And I just love the guy. He's a real sweetheart, especially, you know, back then in a world that was new to me and different, with a lot of sometimes challenging personalities and situations. Eric was always just a soft place. You know, he's very centered. He's very funny. And he knows what he wants, although sometimes it requires a lot of experimenting. But when he hit the scene, we were all pretty amazed, because Eric was bringing something to the table that we all loved hearing and kind of needed. And that was a more forensic focus on tone and more of the guitar being the skeletal foundation of an instrumental piece of music. And more inspired melody, because that music that he was writing and playing, it was so melodic and pleasing and amazing, because his chops, his choice of notes, he's one of those guys that would get into the flow. And so word spread very quickly. But back then, you couldn't turn on YouTube. You know, we didn't even have computers, you know, no cell phones or anything like that. So you had to go see somebody play or try to get to see them on TV. And thank goodness for Austin City Limits, you know, a show like that would play people like that. So we got to see him. But he's been a forever contributor to our great guitar community in a bold, beautiful, and effective way that continues to inspire. And I get to stand right next to him.
Yeah, man. That's awesome. Well, Steve, thank you so much for the time. As always, like talking music, always a pleasure. I will let you run on, but it's good, man. There's a lot up ahead, and we'll look forward to, of course, the Satch Vi dates and beyond.
Thank you, and I'm looking forward to doing my best to be the entertainer that helps make it a great experience for everybody. And thanks so much for anybody for the amazing support over this project, the G3 projects, and that last beat tour. The audience was the stunner.
There you have it. Another episode of the UCR podcast is in the books. I am Matt Wardlaw. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. Please make sure to follow this podcast if you haven't, so you will get future episodes as they're released. And we'd appreciate it also if you would rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. Look, we are all music fans, so if you enjoyed this, you can find a lot more at ultimateclassicrock.com, and we'll see you there.